We remember John Anthony West this week. John passed away on Tuesday, and we'll have a short retrospective of his work from an interview taken in 2014. Actually, John was the very first interview we had here on the program, and we'll get a brief glimpse into his thinking behind the pre-dynastic builders in Egypt and why they're so important to understand from a sacred geometry perspective. We'll hear from media critic Adam Young on select books from John Anthony West, including Serpent in the Sky, which is a very important book, and where you can see some of his videos, including Mystery of the Sphinx, came out, over 25 years ago. We continue our look into ancient Egypt with today's special guest, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who is a clinical hypnotherapist. Dr. Goldberg has regressed over 15,000 people, and many of these people have had significant lifetimes in ancient Egypt. And we're going to hear about some of these lifetimes and some of the startling information that has come from these readings. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For February 10th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? How's it going? Thanks for joining me on Earth Ancients. You're dialing in, you're locked in, and we got a show for you today. Sad news, John Anthony West passed away on Tuesday, and we are going to talk a little bit about him. As a reminder, so we're going to have Robert Schock on the program as a concluding episode to our Egypt series, Saturday the 24th. That'll be the last Saturday of February, and he has some interesting things to say, not only about John, but some of the work that they were working on together, some of the work they were completing together. I had talked with John offline a couple of times. He was in the process of working on a book, a follow-up to Serpent in the Sky with Robert Schock, and we want to hear from Schock about what that was all about. Schock wrote a memorial piece this morning. I have it posted on the Facebook page. You can read it. And he is probably, it looks like he's going to write some a book or two based on some of the notes that John left him or some of the things they were working on together. So anyhow, John had been ill with cancer for about a year. He beat the cancer, but according to his family, his body just kind of gave out. I think he was in his, mid-80s. Big loss, obviously, for a lot of us, for me. John represents a big, big departure from classical Egyptology. When I first started reading his work, it was really quite amazing. And remember, Serpent in the Sky is a book based on the work of Schwaller de Lubitsch, who was a German mathematician who studied pre-dynastic architecture, building design, and believed that these temples and these buildings were imbued with a perfect form, a perfect synergy, what came to be known as sacred geometry. And I've mentioned before in the late 1990s as a program director for a conference called Whole Life, I featured John many times. I flew him out here to speak. He was living in New York. at the time, and the thinking that he developed, which would eventually be linked to Robert Schoch, was what Dlugacz had described as the weathering on the Sphinx. It wasn't an idea that West had. It was something that Dlugacz had written about that John West and Robert Schoch took to the next level and actually analyzed the Sphinx body. From that information, Mystery of the Sphinx was created, which is a series which was hosted by Charlton Heston. It went on to win an Emmy. I remember an interview with John, and later on in the show, we're going to hear an excerpt from a 2014 interview I did with John, where he describes some of the characteristics of these buildings and why they're important to look at and why we can't really grasp it now, because as human beings, we are coming back into a level of sensitivity, a level of conscious awareness of more than just who we are. We're becoming more aware of our surroundings. And this is what these ancient people were able to do, is imbue buildings with the levels of consciousness. So we will hear from John a little bit later in the program and kind of remember him for this wisdom that was imparted to us. Now, today I'm going to introduce a different kind of research format. In the past, we've had best-selling authors providing their research. We've had research investigators. We've had people talk about ancient documents, hieroglyphics, glyphs, geology. But today is a different form of undertaking, a different form of content. And what I want to describe and what I want to say about Earth Ancients is when I'm designing the show, I'm looking for content that feels right, that rings true as much as possible. Sometimes some of the guests we have on, you know, are considered radical. Now, today, we're going to look at research based on hypnotic regression. Now, my guest today is Bruce Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg has regressed 15,000 people, and we're going to present material on past life regressions. And this is people who are looking back through a regression of different lifetimes. And what Dr. Goldberg has been able to do is in his book that we're featuring today is actually tap a number of people, and this is in the hundreds of individuals who lived not a few thousand years ago, but tens of thousands of years ago, and what their impressions were. And this is going to be a fantastic aspect of this show. And Bruce has written a number of books. One, Past Lives, Future Lives, was a bestseller about 20 years ago. So, and he's been on a number of programs. So this is going to be challenging for a certain number of people, but you have to stay open. And this is what I ask of you while you're listening to today's interview, is that you do your best to just kind of follow it along and listen. And if it doesn't ring true, it doesn't ring true. But it's another form of content, another form of information about our past. So I hope you do enjoy this segment. Now, I also want to mention that we're going to be presenting a Earth Ancient Special Edition program at the end of this month on a new book that just came out, a brilliant new book called Cannabis and Spirituality. And the author is a guy named Stephen Gray. Stephen Gray has written a number of books on cannabis. And I mean, I'm here in California and we just legalized it. And I mean, I use cannabis on a ceremonial basis for consciousness expansion and things like that. I've been meditating for over 30 years, but I find that cannabis is the new accelerator. And what that means is that it's helping a lot of people become more aware of their surroundings. And this program, the special edition on cannabis and spirituality, is something to consider. Now, the special edition programs are placed on the same network as Earthy Ancients. So it, when you see it come up in your feed, you can ignore it. You can listen to it. I introduce each show with a quick highlight. And if you don't want to listen to it, just go ahead and move on. But I think you should consider this new program, because cannabis is not only a sacred plant, but it's been around as long as Homo sapiens sapiens have been around. They've discovered that it's tens of thousands of years old, and it has been used for vision quests and enhancements, sensitivity enhancements for thousands and thousands of years. So Cannabis and Spirituality with Stephen Gray will be coming up real soon. And I hope you'll take a listen and see what you think.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Lots to talk about in the news today. The top story, one of the top stories is the reconstruction of Queen Nefertiti's head, taken from what is thought to be her skeletal remains. And this reproduction, which was done after they did like 5,000 scans of this head, is a Caucasian person, and this has brought up a lot of issues as to her background, her true genetic background. Some people thought she came from Central Africa, but there's a lot of questions. I have a problem with it simply because the busts that we have, the sculptures that we have, portray a different person, and I actually question this. But you can see this photograph on the Facebook page, and I also have posted a video that was taken where you can actually see where the camera goes around the circumference of the head and get the details. So this is the latest technology, and I have a problem with it, but I don't know, some of you may feel differently. So check that out on the Facebook page. Scientists at the University of Tulane have now discovered that the Great Maya Guatemala were geoengineers. Now, this is the team that did these lidar scans and discovered over 60,000 new pyramids, buildings, structures in Guatemala. And what makes this discovery quite unique is that what they found were unusual canals, waterways. It looks like they drained swamps and rivers to be able to cultivate food grains, like corn. And the structures, the way they are designed, appear to show a different story than what scientists were thinking. In the past, scientists believe that the Maya overgrew their cities. They were not able to feed their people anymore. That doesn't seem to be the case. Now the story is, where did the Maya go? Because these lidar scans show sophisticated geoengineering, some perfect planning, and were able to provide for the people that lived in these locations, which account for hundreds of thousands of individuals. So this is a new article. This is something I've always questioned when they have said in the past that the Maya eventually grew too large in population and were not able to provide for the new population. So articles on the Facebook page. Hundreds of the mounds have been found in the outback of Australia, and they are now pinpointing the Aborigines as building these mounds. They've found them by scanning various sections of the outback, and they didn't know actually what these mounds were. They look like they're apparently they're burial mounds, and they amount to many, many hundreds. And there's some strange patterns that have been found in these outback locations. Apparently, the Aborigines designed and built these mounds in such a way that not only is there a burial, but there's also some indication that there's some landform designs that were incorporated into these burials. Scientists in England have done some DNA tests on a series of skeletal remains. It appears that these remains reveal the first Britons about 10,000 years ago were dark-skinned, blue-eyed individuals. And these are very unusual-looking people. A lot of controversy has come up from this. They have done a complete reconstruction of one of these that they've found. And you can see this in its entirety on the Facebook page, which is on the earthancients.com page. This has brought up a lot of questions about these first people. Hard to say when they make these claims that these were the first people, but who knows? Check it out. I've also put a huge gallery of the pyramid number 5, which is found in Tikal. I have a small gallery. We will be traveling to Tikal and climbing pyramid number 5. Now, what's unique about this is a huge, huge pyramid. I think it stands over 100 feet in the air, maybe 120 feet, I think. And they developed and put together a stairwell on the left side as you walk, if you face the pyramid. And the stairwell goes to the very, very top where you can actually see it for miles and get an idea of how, you know, the design of these pyramids. You can see all the news. We have lots of galleries. We have articles, information on the latest in ancient history. On Facebook, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group page, and you can see all the details. All this information is automatically stored also on the earthancients.com. In memory of John Anthony West, I wanted to play a short clip from an interview that I did with him on March 3rd of 2014, which so happens to be the very first program of Earth Ancients. And this is an interesting, just 3.5 minute clip, which summarizes what his impact, what John Anthony West's impact is on the historic notions of ancient Egyptians. And you're going to hear how he discovered this information, how it was disseminated, and how he proceeded to publish, along with Dr. Robert Schock, this vital information that changes our understanding of ancient history. Here's the cut.
I mean, I've been on this trail since I was doing my first, got commissioned to do the book on Shuala de Lubitz, the serpent in the sky, and it was de Lubitz who, in a book, the genius with the unpronounceable name, when one of his books, shortly before he died, but called the sacred, translated as the sacred science, the king of the pharaonic theocracy. It was Schwaller who noted that the Great Sphinx had been weathered by water and not by wind and sand. And this came to me as an epiphany, because nobody had ever suggested this before. I think Schwaller himself did not realize what a bombshell he had discovered. And he died about a year after that book was published, so I don't know if he really realized how important it was, but I did, because I realized that if he could prove that the Great Sphinx, the greatest, the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, and its adjacent temples, which are, you know, built of blocks of stone that weigh upwards of 100 tons, slotted into place like take like pieces of a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, you would totally destroy the basic premise of what I call the Church of Progress, which is the credo of modern progressive rationalist materialist philosophy, which is, of course, as you said earlier, that progress is a linear process, starting with simple cavemen and going in a straight line up to wonderful old us with Disneyland and hydrogen bombs and drones and all the great stuff that we have at our disposal. So in and of itself, the water weathering to the Sphinx and its redating throws that entire, the whole paradigm has to be changed. And that in and of itself, you might say, because the people sometimes do say to me, well, you know, who cares if the Sphinx is 10,000 years old or 30,000 years old or 4,500 years old, as the academics claim. What difference does it make? The difference that it makes is that we watch our own so-called civilization, which isn't civilization at all, it's shiny barbarism, our technologically advanced era. We watch it crumbling in front of our eyes. I mean, everything that happens, anytime we turn on the news, be it cable or network or, you know, the real news, which doesn't get much attention from cable and network on television, but it does on the internet, where you can actually access real stuff. We watch this crumbling in front of our eyes. And when Egypt is understood for what it really is, which is, again, the opposite of what the academics, who I call the quackademics, say that it is. And on my trips, I think we didn't mention this yet, I take study trips to the really pilgrimages to Egypt to introduce people to this extraordinary civilization. They recognize at the end of a couple of weeks the difference between what we call progress and what they call civilization.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, John's partner in this research, Dr. Robert Schock, will be my guest Saturday the 24th. We're going to hear details of some of the information that he is working on, Robert is working on, and some insights into what John was working on at the time of his passing. So stay tuned for that. That program is the culminating program for the Egyptian series. I've mentioned this before. And we are going to drill down into what is being discovered now, the work that both John Anthony West and Dr. Robert Schock have continued, and what we can expect in the future. So stay tuned for that information. So this week, our media critic Adam Young is going to provide us with some details on John Anthony West, and it's important that you understand his significance, his contributions, and I'm looking forward to hearing what Adam has to present. Adam, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks.
All right, man. So what's up with John Anthony West? What do you got for us?
Well, he was one of the most important, I think, authors in the last 20 years to write on these topics, ancient Egypt, the sacred knowledge of cultures that have sort of long been gone. And he unfortunately passed away a few days ago. But his work, I think, is still contemporary, still worth learning as much as you can about his life, because the things that he found important, he also got from other people. And he was always very forthcoming and giving recommendations and trying to spread knowledge. He wasn't just someone who woke up one day and invented anything. I mean, everything in his life, he read from others, he developed it, he added his own personal sense and his own take on things, and then he tried to leave the the world better than where he found it. So, all right. So John Anthony West was inspired by the work of Schwaller de Lubitz, who was a French researcher in the early 1900s. Schwaller lived in Egypt for, I think, 10 or 15 years, and he studied in particular some of the massive temples, the Temple of Luxor in particular. He drew very elaborate sketches of it. And what he found was that the temple was sort of a model of how nature and how life propagates. It's a model of the human body, and it has things like the Fibonacci sequence encoded into it, which is something that describes how all life on Earth replicates at the cellular and molecular level. And he pushed this theory that hieroglyphics are not just the account of how a pharaoh harvested grain or executed someone or enslaved someone. They were actually highly esoteric symbols for science and sacred geometry. And the language of ancient Egypt, the hieroglyphs themselves, were actually a form of code. And the code was math, science, geometry, and the laws that govern our species and our universe. John Anthony West at some point came across this and entirely took it on as his own and wanted to dedicate the rest of his life towards it, essentially. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a book in 1979 called The Serpent in the Sky. This should be tabletop reading for anyone interested in the subject at all. You can buy it on Amazon. It was updated, I think, in the 90s. John updated it a little bit to coincide with a documentary he did called Mystery of the Sphinx. But The Serpent in the Sky, he lays out his case for high technology and extreme antiquity of Egypt. He takes on Schwaller de Lubitz's point of view, and he puts it into his own words. He talks about hieroglyphs, how they really convey a very ancient and sacred science. And by very ancient, essentially the Egyptians themselves said that this stuff came to us. Their knowledge is from an earlier time. And that's right. What Schwaller attempted to kind of work with. But John Anthony even says it's very difficult reading through Schwaller's notes. So as a professional writer, I think West had an easier time of doing it. But it is it's a highly intricate, very, very long story, as you know. So yeah. I think John was probably one of the earlier, most successful contemporary writers in terms of being able to just talk to the general public about this subject.
Right. Serpent in the Sky is a very important book for those of you listening. And again, you probably can get it for $5 or less on Amazon because it's been out for so long. Let's move forward. For those of you who are like me, who don't have a chance to read the movie, which was his coming of age, so to speak. John and Dr. Robert Schock were featured in Mystery of the Sphinx. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? And it's actually available for free, isn't it, on YouTube?
Yes, it's still on YouTube, although the quality is not the best, but free is free. So check that out. It's about an hour and a half, narrated by Charlton Heston. It won an Emmy for Best Research in a Documentary, and it was nominated for Best Overall Documentary in 93, I think.
Wow.
Charlton Heston was a pretty big name to get on.
Yeah.
So I think it's based on what John Anthony researched for Serpent in the Sky. When he was writing this book, he said, you know, I can go on and relate. I can relate symbolism, and I can take the hieroglyphics and say this is a much more advanced, much ancient culture than everyone thinks. But how do I really prove it to people that don't want to get into esoteric symbolism? And he said, one of the last things Schwaller wrote before he died was, oh, if you want proof, check out the water erosion on the Sphinx. And I think a light went off in John Anthony's head when he got to that and said, okay, well, let me find a geologist. So he scoured the U.S. He found Robert Schock, who is a tenured geologist at Boston University in Boston. And Schock agreed to come. And what Dr. Robert Schock did was essentially lay out the case that the water erosion around the Sphinx enclosure is the result of many thousands of years of, and that hasn't happened since at least at least predating what the traditional timeline is, which is 2500 BC. So he was saying it's at least 5,000 years before that, possibly much older. And both of them have, I think, since made the case that the timeline should be pushed out far before that, as far as before the Ice Age ended at 10,000 BC or 9,700 BC. I think Schock is not firmly stated that, but in either case, it's older than people think. And I think that's borne out by the water erosion around the enclosure. That was one of the focal points of the documentary. And for anyone that hasn't seen that, you can see that in other documentaries as well. But this one was on NBC, was on prime time.
Great. Adam Young, our media critic. I appreciate the insight. And again, for those of you listening, this information is available on the Facebook or earthancients.com. And you can access that quite easily. We look forward to your next report. Thanks again, Adam.
Thanks, Cliff.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Vital Transport is the travel agency for Earth Ancients, and our first trip this year is to Guatemala, June 15th through the 24th. This is a chance to see Mayan pyramids, structures, tons of artifacts, tons of very important museums and venues in an environment that allows you to take in Mayan culture in its full nature. We fly into Guatemala City. We travel and have a full excursion. We go to Copan, Guiligua. We go to Tikal and smaller cities in between. We're going to see the top museums. We're even going to check out some of the local communities in Guatemala so we get the full sense of what life is like there. And it's going to be a great trip. We only have a few seats left. If you're interested, go to earthancients.com/tours or toll free 844-368-4825. Each week I've been posting photographs of a number of the pyramid complexes we'll be climbing. One of the big treats of this tour is that when we go to Tikal, we will get special access to a number of pyramids. The one I'm looking forward to climbing is the World Pyramid, simply because it is actually a generator. It's actually working, and we'll have a great time to get up on top of there and get a sense of some of these energetics. So come out and join me June 15th through the 24th, and you can get more information toll free 844-368-4825.
So we continue our talk, our interest in all things ancient Egypt. And this week, my guest is someone that I actually worked with. We were just talking before the beginning of this interview, somebody who I worked with probably 20 years ago when I was the program director of Whole Life Expo here in the San Francisco Bay Area, Dr. Bruce Goldberg. And talk about a fascinating character. Dr. Goldberg regressed thousands of people. I think at the time it was 15,000. Now it must be over 20, 25. We'll ask him here in a minute. But he wrote a bestseller called Past Lives, Future Lives. And his research really, really touches on the ancient past, but also a lot of other subjects that are unique. This bestseller, Past Lives, Future Lives, as well as another book called The Search for Grace, actually got him on a number of national shows. His work has been referred to by a number of authors. And today we're talking about a book called Egypt, An Extraterrestrial and Time Travels Experiment. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Cliff. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me just comment on some of your introduction. I appreciate your kind introduction. Past Lives, Future Lives was my first book, and it became, thank goodness, an international bestseller. But even in that book, one of my past lives did deal with ancient Egypt during the building of the pyramids, so it does have a correlation indirectly to our interview. The book you also mentioned, my second book, The Search for Grace, was made into a CBS movie. It was a movie for television about a documented case of reincarnation. And that got a lot of attention, you can imagine. So it was.
Yeah.
But I've written 21 books altogether. The Egypt book, which is subtitled Egypt, an Extraterrestrial and Time Travel Experiment, is going to deal with a lot of fun topics, everything from extraterrestrials to chrononauts or time travelers from our future, and the true history of Egypt, which you don't read about in your typical college courses in ancient history.
I know. This is why we have you on the program. Now, you know, before we move forward, how many people have you regressed at this stage in 2018? Because I've known you for quite a few years.
I don't like keep computer records, but roughly it's about 19,000 patients of mine who have been regressed. And don't forget, I developed the field of taking people into future life, progression hypnotherapy.
Yeah.
My first book, Past Life, Future Lives, is the first book, which is originally published in 1982, is the first book ever written on taking people into future lives. But what I want to do is, when it comes to the Egypt book, just for your audience, I want to give them something that is kind of relevant here. At the end of the interview, of course, I'll give you my website. If your listeners and viewers, if they order my Egypt book directly from my site, because of your show, I'm going to give them a free gift, which is going to be a CD called Fifth Dimensional Travel, which will allow them to go into the fifth dimension to explore their past lives, to explore maybe their ties to ancient Egypt. Almost everybody around has lived in Egypt at least once in a past life, I can tell you that. And they can experience going out of the body very safely, too. So it's a lot of fun things. So if they mention the show and they order the Egypt book and they simply say, this is Cliff's show, you know, blah, 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 and I'd like the free gift, I will automatically send them the CD that they can use very simply with instructions on how to do this themselves.
Very good. Hey, before we move forward, let's talk a little bit about your what you do. You're a clinical hypnotherapist. So your clients are people who are trying to, what, stop smoking, get rid of phobias. I mean, what is the
okay, so
the
let,
basis
let me just show this. First, I use the word patients rather than clients. I do have three degrees.
Okay.
I have my undergraduate training is in biochemistry. I have a dental degree. That's my doctorate. And I have a master's in counseling psychology. So when people come to me, it's not just the usual things that any other therapist would see. Yes, I deal with depression, anxiety, and habits, et cetera. But a lot of them are new age goals. They want to explore past lives, future lives. They want to explore parallel universes, which is what I do too. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book called Custom Design Your Own Destiny about going into parallel universes. They want to do ascension training so they can increase their own spiritual growth to cut down or eliminate the need to reincarnate. That's a big issue and a very important one, so it's a spiritual issue. There's a lot of spiritual and metaphysical issues I deal with, and teleportation is also part of my work, which is the heavy stuff. This is out-of-body experience is one level, and then teleportation is the other. And my most recent book, Exploring the Fifth Dimension, goes into all those out-of-body travel and teleportation and parallel universes in detail techniques.
Yeah.
So my practice is very unusual on that level. It's not just your typical, I've got a problem with depression or anxiety, or I can't stand my boss, or I got some OCD. Yes, I treat those, but I treat them from an energy-raising perspective, which means no drugs and cause removal. So that's the real theme of what I do.
Well, you know, it's funny. Years ago, I think some of the topics were past lives and what you had discovered. But I never asked you this, Bruce. When you started getting clients having these bleed through lifetimes, was this a shock to you that they may have been living, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, and that these lives were so significant?
Well, I'll tell you what the relevancy was. I was in dental school at the time when I started doing hypnosis and regressions. And the thing that was, I'm a clinician at heart, okay? I mean, yes, I do research. I publish a couple dozen scientific articles, and I am well-known. And I used to teach a graduate course in a rather well-known university in this. But my main thing is clinical. So when I was doing regressions, at first I didn't care much about the details because the patients were making major therapeutic progress, overcoming issues. That was my main thing. But right. then The Search for Grace case, remember, that was my second book. That movie was aired in on May 17th, 1994. So that was the time of, you know, just about the time you and I knew each other, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So when that when I had the details from that particular case, it was a very dramatic case. It was 46 regressions, and one of them I had dozens and dozens of documentable data that came up. And when the network contacted, or one of my people contacted the network about doing the movie, they checked it out. And it, as it turned out, not only did the details all check out, but there were two of them that didn't. And the newspapers at the time, remember, this was 1927 in Buffalo, New York, the newspapers at the time reported two facts that were different than what my patient gave. As it turned out, when they did the actual research with birth and death certificate records, my patient was right and the reporters were wrong. So it was the most documented case of the last century. So to me, when it comes to people say, is this all just yada yada, or is people's making things up? Well, the Search for Grace case pretty much puts that aside. I mean, there are other documented cases, but mine is relevant because this was about a woman who was dating a guy who tried to murder her on three different occasions, and she couldn't break up with him. So it's a pretty heavy case. Serious. It was a really serious case.
Yeah.
You talk about Me Too issues. This is Me Too 46. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you say that now your practice has evolved into people wanting to touch into their past lives, and this is why this book is so fascinating. Let's start talking about this book.
Sure.
The book covers multiple points of view of the ancient world, with contributions from a number of different civilizations and off-world beings. You cover Lemuria, which is Mu. You cover Atlantis. You cover extraterrestrials and time travelers. Were you shocked to learn that Egypt was not settled by just one group?
Oh, no. I'll tell you why I wasn't shocked. You have to understand one thing about me. I have a very strong academic background, okay? I've probably read over 800 books in my life. And I never accepted the traditional explanation for Egypt. Now, I know a lot about archaeology, and any archaeologist or historian will tell you that civilizations don't come from nowhere. There's always a preliminary expansions of cultures, they call them, and they eventually evolve a little bit more, a little bit more. Look at the history of ancient Rome and Greece, and if you go into China and all the other civilizations. However, Egypt came from nowhere. There was nothing around. All of a sudden, they're building pyramids that we can't recreate today. Okay, and if you know the history of I'm sure you do, about the Pyramid of Giza and the Giza Plateau, how it mimics the Earth, and you know the perfect north, perfect south, east and west, and all the numbers and the work of the of West and Choke and stuff. I'm sure you're familiar with that. So, so what happened here? Well, it's logical that, or shall I say, it's illogical that the historians are correct. I mean, they're always wrong about certain things, okay? And they don't like metaphysics because they don't like Atlantis, Lemuria. So this is what I found out. I did a lot of research, and this is called, and I'm going to quote you a very important scientific law. This is not a theory, and I'll show you how it applies to this. This is called Whately's Law of Evidence. This is like circumstantial evidence for science. Certain things in science we can't do experiments on. It's just impossible to experiment. We can't get the situation. So this is what they say. If people from all over the world, now think about this, who have no contact with each other, and they all tell you the same thing, it must be true. That makes sense? It's circumstantial evidence, right?
Yeah.
Just like if somebody complains about somebody else, and they say, oh, that person could just be a freak, they could be angry at them. But if 25 people who don't know each other tell you the same story, then that person's got a problem. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened was that when I started doing the work and the research, especially with Egypt, and Egypt has always been a popular interest of mine, I was dealing with patients. My practice is international. I see people from all over the world. So these are people from Australia, South America, Europe, Canada, you name it. And they're all telling me the same basic things. I mean, not all the details are the same, but there's certain things that key on. This is what I found. This is what my regressions over the years have discovered. Egypt began first you had the ancient continent of Lemuria, or Mu as it's called, and that was established about 200,000 years ago, and about 100,000 years BC, they started doing colonies, and their first major colony was Atlantis. Well,
right.
Atlantis later on became the bastard child, so to speak, and decided to declare war on them. Atlantis was like ancient Rome. It was a viciously materialistic and militaristic society, although they had spiritual things too, but they had some bad dudes. And so both Atlantis and Lemuria both established colonies in Egypt. Atlantis took what's called Lower Egypt, which is the northern part, like Cairo today. Lemuria, Lemu, took the southern part, which is called
Upper Egypt. What's the rough time period that this happened, the north and south?
We're looking at about 16,000 B.C.
16,000 B.C., so about 20,000 years ago.
Right. This is before the flood now, okay? So you understand. By the way, there was a major flood. This isn't what the whole world wasn't underwater. No, this is not I'm not into the Noah's Ark mentality, but there were major floods throughout the world. We have evidence of that. Okay, so what happened is that, so 16,000 B.C., Lemuria goes to the southern part, which is called Upper Egypt, and Atlantis to the northern part, which is called Lower Egypt. And so Atlantis pretty much didn't want Lemuria there, so Lemuria had to go there by way of India, which was one of its major colonies, in the old Rama Empire of ancient India, if you know anything about that. That was a Lemurian settlement, okay? So then they would fly. They had like little crafts. They had planes in those days. They had a lot of, they had atomic power, too. This is pretty heavy. So they would fly from India to the lower part of Egypt, which is almost like the border of Sudan today. Well, that was, so you had both Lemuria first and Atlantis. Then you also had extraterrestrials that were involved, okay, with the technology and this and that. And they did a lot of work, especially in designing the pyramids, et cetera, and some of the other technological things, most of which has been lost other than the pyramids because of the floods. And then, of course, you had the biggie, the most important influence, and the one that was the saving grace of our Axis society were the time travelers. Because the extraterrestrials, if they really wanted, they could have taken over the planet. I mean, we're talking about primitive men, you know. We're not talking about the military that we have today. We're talking about extraterrestrials that are probably a million years ahead of us in time and evolution. So who was to protect us? Well, it was the time travelers from our future, which I call Tronauts. So those are the four influences: Lemuria or Mu, Atlantis, ETs, and the time travelers. That was the, right. That was the basis of establishing Egypt as a. Now, Egypt is important for a lot of reasons. We get the first monarchies were Egyptian. We get in ancient Egypt, the only ancient civilization that ever existed in which women had community property rights was ancient Egypt. Very interesting, okay? Egypt gave us a lot of the technology. Although we got astrology from Sumeria, Egypt perfected it. Okay, mathematics was definitely perfected by Egypt. All the Greeks would, you know, Pythagoras, everybody studied in Egypt, okay? Everybody studied the Egyptian geometry and Euclidean geometry, et cetera. So Egypt gave us a lot of stuff. I mean, much of our technology came here. And as a matter of fact, if we have time to discuss it, there's also a theological thing that comes from Egypt, too. The first monotheist was Akhenaten, Amenhotep IV, who became Akhenaten.
We'll see if we have time to cover that.
Yeah.
I think my big question to you is, and this is interesting because you're saying part of northern and southern Egypt was one was Atlantis, one was Mu or Lemuria. When would you say it came together? What's the inception date for the pyramid, the Sphinx, and these important buildings in the Giza Plateau? What is the dates of those creations?
Well, you have to understand there isn't a date. There's an evolution involved. In my Egypt book, I talk about a past life that occurred in 15,000 BC, okay, where you don't have the pyramids built yet, okay? But then there's another life that's occurring around 9500 BC in which the Sphinx is already created, but the pyramid's about two-thirds done. So you see,
this is a patient that's lived at that time. They actually saw the Sphinx, and they were participating in the society.
Right. They were actually living in ancient Egypt. This was 91 was 16. The one from I'll tell you what, the best thing to do, if can I take just a few moments to summarize them, because they're really interesting lives.
Yeah, please. I'd love to hear and what their roles were in this ancient time period. Love to hear it.
So here, this is a life of this woman. Her name is Meru, M-E-R-U. She was born in Mu or Lemuria, and she lived there for the first 275 years of her life. Look at the lifespan here.
Long life. Wow.
Well, believe me, you know how the Old Testament talks about people living to be almost 1,000. Well, this is why it becomes relevant. Okay, so she was trained as an architect. and she wanted to design temples and buildings in Egypt, which is, of course, set up at that time, the beginning of Lemurian colonization of Egypt. But she couldn't because there was a lot of wars going on between Atlantis and Lemuria from the north. The Atlantis have a northern part of the country, and they were just killing people like crazy. It was civil war time. So eventually, by the time she was 275, she went to India, and then she flew in a big plane from India to the southern part of Egypt, which is Upper Egypt, we call that. And she set up as an architect, okay? Okay, so that's fine, and she's doing this for a few years, but there's a lot of problems with the civil war going on. Eventually, she is killed it's about 375 years, so it's 100 years later. By the time she's 375 years old, she's been in Egypt for several years, she's eventually killed in one of the wars that went on, one of the local excursions. But here's a woman that went from Lemuria to India to Egypt. Okay.
Wow.
So this is a pretty. Now there's another life which is this gets even heavier. This is even more fun. Meru's life is significant because she lived a long time and did her thing. But there's another gentleman who lived in Egypt about 9500 BC. Okay?
Okay.
So this is before the flood again. Okay. And he's the one who describes how the Sphinx is fully constructed, but the Giza pyramid is only about two-thirds done. So what he was describing is he was like a carpenter, okay? This wasn't Jesus, by the way, okay? This guy's a carpenter, okay? And he's like a blue-collar worker, right? Okay, so he's going to work one day, and all of a sudden there are like laser beams from the sky. These crafts are flying around it's almost like Star Wars here. Okay, and these they're shooting these lightning bolts down, and people are being killed, and destruction like crazy, and they don't know what's going on. What he was describing was an ET war between the Zeta Reticuli, which are the Greys, and the Pleiadians, which are the good guys here. You know, the Pleiadians are, although they're genetically related, the Pleiadians are very peaceful and very positive ETs. So they were fighting each other. They were just blowing up buildings and killing people and doing all kinds of crazy things. So finally, they were trying to get to the end of this war. There was an end. There were other crafts that came in that became peacekeepers that eventually negotiated the settlement. And who were these peacekeepers? Their crafts were more advanced. Their weapons were more advanced, so obviously you're overwhelmed. You know, you're going to, like, instead of killing yourself, you're going to be cool. These were time travelers from our future. These were the ones that actually settled the war and allowed people to settle down and eventually solve the problem. So this
how did your patients describe a time? I mean, is it like, okay, in their recounting of these lifetimes, are they saying, well, they're known as, I mean, how do they identify time travelers is my question.
I mean, travelers are easy
somebody
to identify.
You're a time traveler? I mean, how are they identified?
Okay, first of all, there are certain characteristics of time travelers. If you're running into a life where you see a bunch of people that are advanced and the head of so let me describe a time travel team. First of all, if you see a craft with a triangular insignia, you know it's always from the future. That's a slam dunk given characteristic. That's
triangular feature, okay.
A triangle insignia, like a triangle insignia, like inside a circle, for example, like an emblem, like would be on a uniform kind of thing, or a ship.
Right.
They would have that too. That's always futuristic. Secondly, the pure human is the head of a time traveler team, especially the early teams. And these guys are about 6.5 feet tall. They have piercing blue eyes. They wear white robes, and they communicate telepathically. Okay, that's a pretty pretty good MO for a time traveler, okay? Not too many people are floating around. Now, they do have extraterrestrials as part of their team. They do have grays and hybrids, but the majority of them are pure human. So obviously, that's quite different than the grays or the reptilians or the other hybrid type of ETs that are floating around. But they will identify themselves. They have superior technology. They're very spiritual, and they will telepathically communicate, if not verbally, but very often they use telepathic communication to tell you who they are. So they identify themselves because they don't want to be killed, and they want the people on the earth, us primitive, especially primitive earthlings, not to panic, and this and that.
Yeah.
By the way, let me just tell you about the first time traveler team, because this relates to ancient Egypt. Time travel, it's interesting, the year 3000 is going to be relevant here. 3100 BC is a relevant time in the history of mankind because that's when Egypt was unified as the first state. Before 3100 BC, there were no, quote, states. But 3100 BC, the northern and southern part of Egypt were unified. And that was, if you ever saw the movie The Scorpion King, that was a man named Nor Aha, and that, because that Hollywood went crazy. It didn't exactly make it a docudrama, but that was the first king of the, or the first pharaoh of the unified nation. Now, what's relevant about the year 3000, if you go to about 3100 AD now, that's when time travel will be discovered. So I know there's all kinds of junk out there, and you go to New Age workshops and stuff. Trust me, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been working with time travelers for 25 years, okay, or more. So in the year 3100 AD, there's a man named Tatos, T-A-A-T-O-S, who will be the first time traveler. He's like a scientist. He's like the Leonardo da Vinci of his time. He's a scientist. He's a philosopher. He's got a whole bunch of – he got more degrees than a thermometer, okay? And so what he does is he develops the what's called the wormhole linear accelerator, which is a mechanical a technique to actually enlarge a wormhole to classic size and allow a craft to go through it and to travel through a wormhole back in time. So the first team that's set up in 3100 AD, give or take, is these are the people on the first time travel team. Tatos, Geb, Osiris, Isis. Got it? Okay, make it ring a bell.
Okay.
Yes.
They all
became Egyptian gods because if you go back in time and these primitive Egyptians see these people with these crafts and anti-gravity flying crafts and building the pyramids with using anti-gravity devices, which is how they built them, by the way, you're going to worship them as gods, okay? And especially if they're human-looking, okay? ETs would be killed and some of the other races were killed, that's true, but the pure humans, especially the Caucasians, not to be racist, folks, but that's just the way it works, okay? That's what they did. So that basically...
Let me stop you there. That's a good explanation. So let's focus on Egypt for a bit. So what was, would you consider, the level of development when Mu and Atlantis came together to form Egypt? Were they 500 years ahead of us today, 1,000 years in a day? I mean, obviously, they were sophisticated because they had flying machines.
Here's the problem. Okay, here's the problem with that. I'll give you the answer to that, but it's not going to be as logical as you may seem. In Lemuria, they developed they had nuclear weapons. Okay, they had nuclear power, and so did Atlantis. In fact, if you ever read the Mahabharata, which I do quote in the Egypt book, you've got a copy of that. There is a scene. There is a section of the Mahabharata, which is it's the longest epic poem in history, where they talk about a nuclear war. Basically, it's a nuclear war. Okay.
Right.
And there is, by the way, there's academic evidence now. There's radiation records or exposures that we know in northern India that were dated thousands of years ago. We only had nuclear weapons since 1945.
We talked about that in our program a couple of times.
There's no such thing as a spontaneous nuclear explosion. You got to have pure water and a whole bunch of other stuff, and plutonium and whatever. Okay, so basically, Atlantis and Lemuria both were well advanced, far beyond us, actually, more than advanced than we are today. Okay, except the problem with Egypt, because it was like establishing a new colony, because they were constantly fighting each other, they didn't have the nuclear weapons there. They didn't have the technology because they were a beginning civilization, and they were beginning an offshoot or settlement. And by the time you can't develop a lot of fun buildings and things with people blowing you up all the time. It's like having terrorists around every 2 minutes. So basically, the technology of Atlantis and Lemuria was not translated into Egypt other than the construction. They did build a lot of temples and a lot of buildings and this and that. And they had some vehicles and things like that. But all that would have been destroyed by the floods at about 11,000 BC. Give or take. So the technology in Egypt was not comparable to the motherland, so to speak, of Lemuria or Atlantis.
Hey, come out and take a vacation with me June 15th through the 24th. We're going to go to Guatemala. We're going to Mayaland. And this is a great opportunity to explore, to experience Mayan culture, upfront and personal. We're going to go to the top three Mayan cities in Guatemala. That is Tikal, Copan, Quirigua. And each of these locations has places that have sacred buildings, sacred, it actually has sanctuaries where you can sit and kind of take everything in. And on top of that, we're going to go and check out all the museums. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours or call 844-368-4825. That's 844-368-4825. Come on, check it out. We're going to have a blast.
Fascinating.
And by the way, in the Mahabharata, they describe these flying crafts that were sending nuclear weapons down. They call these the Valiks. Was the east the Vimanas was the Indian version of the flying crafts, and the Valiks is the Atlantean version. So
I want to talk to you about those flying crafts in a minute. But one of the things that you bring up in your book that I thought was fascinating was the development of Homo sapiens sapiens, and in your description of Mu, which is Lemuria, and their influence on Egypt, you describe an earlier period of Mu as the Garden of Eden, because not only it has a great age, but it's the spawning ground of modern man. Can you talk a little bit about that and how old that would have been when this modern man shows up?
Well, remember, we're talking about 200,000 BC to begin. That's the beginning of the Lemurian civilization. We think they were seeded mostly for extraterrestrials because our species evolved. By the way, there's academic evidence that Homo sapiens sapiens, our species, has been around for 200,000 years. Okay, there's been recent discoveries in Australia and in Africa to show that. So this isn't a comic book version, okay? So 200,000 BC, this is before Atlantis. Now, Atlantis was the problem. So Lemuria was a developing, growing, very spiritual civilization. They would do out-of-body experiences throughout the day. They were just, you know, they were just really spiritual. Our races developed or evolved from Lemuria. It was the true Garden of Eden. The Lemuria in the Pacific Ocean is the equivalent of Atlantis in the Atlantic, except Lemuria was one big mama. It was 6,000 miles from east to west and 3,000 miles from north to south. And right. Hawaii today is the midpoint of, it's sort of like a remnant of the ancient continent of Lemuria. So it was right in the middle. That's one reason why it survived. So it really was an ideal civilization. They had these people who were called Essenes. Now, if you study the history of Christianity, you'll read about the Essenes. But they were really Lemurians. They were very spiritual. And the problem was they had another group in Lemuria eventually was called the Atlantes, like spelt like Atlantis, except it's E-S instead of I-S. And they were the ones that eventually settled the Atlantis, and they became militaristic and very creepy when it comes to a civilization. But Lemuria, for the first 100,000 years of its existence, was a very spiritual civilization. They had they were very New Age. They worshipped one god. They were very spiritual. There was no racism or prejudice or wars going on. It was a beautiful, beautiful civilization. Their holy writings were called the Seven Sacred Inspired Writings. And actually, technically, according to my research, they were the actual source in the temple of Mount Sinai when Moses was there. He actually had copies of that, or at least certain remnants of that, as the religion, as the theology devolved. As you'll see, Egypt was very big in the history of theology today. So Lemuria was just an ideal civilization. But unfortunately, whenever you have any kind of ideal civilization or anything that works well, there are always people, there are always degenerate freaks that try to wreck the civilization. That's why we have crime today. Not everybody's a criminal, but there's always a bunch of people, a small percentage, who want to kill people, sell drugs, commit terrorism. There's always a certain percentage of real losers in society that are very angry. And, you know, so Lemuria had that too, but not for the first 100,000 years. For the first 100,000 years, they were very ideal. They eventually set civilizations up, and I told you, India, they had Babylonia, they had the Mayans, Egypt, of course, the southern part anyway. These were colonies of Lemuria. So they were the first.
Yeah, I want to get into those, the Maya in a second. But can you describe the evolution of this Homo sapiens sapiens? Was it a natural, what Darwin would say, natural selection, where an offshoot would not live, and this pure Homo sapiens sapien was developed and over just years, or was there any?
Okay,
genetic...
so let me give you my scientific background. If you talk to an archaeologist or even a medically trained person, they'll tell you about how the reason why modern man became very different from Homo erectus, one of our predecessors, or Neanderthal, yeah. which wasn't a direct ancestor, or Homo neanderthalensis and Neanderthal. Homo heidelbergensis in Germany, that skull was found as that's our immediate ancestor. The reason why we evolved differently was because they say, well, we ate meat, which is true. Meat gives you more intelligence. I'm sorry for the vegetarians out there, but if you want to get smart, you need magnesium, okay, in your brain, okay, and you get that from meat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's fine, except it doesn't work from a numbers perspective. Going from a Neanderthal man, which lived from 400,000 BC to we've killed him off about 25,000 BC, it doesn't work. We were genetically manipulated. That's how modern man developed, not only in the brain case being larger, but also in the intelligence, the digital dexterity of the thumb, the gray matter. All this is not natural. We should be basically not swinging in trees, but we should be almost like a Neanderthal man today. So there was genetic manipulation. And Lemuria itself was also involved in manipulating our species genetically. But there was also an extraterrestrial interference. That's where the ETs come in. The ETs were very big in Atlantis and Lemuria, and especially Lemuria.
Wow. You just left a time bomb by saying that. Well, you're going to have to continue. So you're saying that we have had genetic manipulation in these very, very old periods in our history. And so did you have a scientist that you regressed or somebody that can talk a little bit? Can you talk a little bit about what this,
well, I'll tell you who one of my heroes is. A man recently passed away a few years ago. Francis Crick is the co-discoverer of DNA. Watson and Crick discovered DNA in 1953, and that's the basis of modern medicine today, okay, mm-hmm. and cloning and all the things that we do. Now, Crick was in, like, his late 80s, and he was not a senile guy. He was a Nobel Prize laureate. This is a really sharp dude, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this is what he said. When they asked him about the evolution of mankind, he got involved, and he developed what's called the panspermia theory. Now, remember, this is from a Nobel Prize laureate. This is a co-discoverer of DNA. And this is what he said. Panspermia, he said, the evolution of species today about the multicellular organisms, and, you know, 550 million years ago, there was only single-celled organisms, and what's going on? He said, let me tell you, he says, panspermia is the seeding of animals on this planet by extraterrestrials. And this was his analogy. I think it's really cute, and I want to repeat it here because it's kind of relevant. He said, for modern man to evolve from single-celled organisms 550 million years ago, in just a matter of a few million years, he says, this is the analogy. Let's say you owned a junkyard in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you had a bunch of spare parts of various planes, and there was a tornado that came in. And as a result of the tornado, after it ended, you had a working 747. That would be the odds. That would be the odds of having mankind developed by the traditional evolutionary mentality. Of course, it's a joke. I mean, you have to understand they talk about the Cambrian explosion, the Permian extinction, you know, 99% of the species have been eliminated. Okay, that's fine. And I understand that. But you can't evolve the way we have.
Yeah.
You can't evolve. Exactly. Why didn't gorillas do this? Why didn't they evolve and make movies like Star Wars, okay? Why is it just us? What about the dolphins? They're really smart, by the way, but they don't have fingers, you know? I mean, so but in other words, are we the chosen species, you know? I mean, it just doesn't make sense from an evolution. So I believe in evolution. I just believe in a compartmentalized form. I don't believe that we came from the primordial soup. Because you have to understand, I'm a biochemist by training. The macromolecules that make up our cells, you can't just take carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, throw them together in some soup and get life. We've been trying to do that for the last 60 years, ever since Watson and Crick's work, and we've never been able to create life in the laboratory. We can transfer nuclei, but we can't create life from nothing.
Okay. It's funny you mentioned that. We had Dr. Chandra Wickramsey on our program, who with Hoyle, Dr. Hoyle, believe that the Earth has been seeded, and he believes in intelligent intent. In other words, extraterrestrial intent, and that the Earth's been seeded not only by microbes, but by various asteroids that have opened up and created different kinds of life forms.
Well, okay, I'll tell you the simple thing. Microorganisms is not – nobody argues the microorganisms. We get comets. You know, the reason why we have oceans on this planet is because mm-hmm. we've had so many comets and asteroids hit the planet in the old days. And when you – microbes can go through space. They can survive under ice. 750 million years ago to 550 million years BC, the Earth was an ice cube. It was solid ice. And we had microorganisms who lived, or else you wouldn't have life today. Okay,
yeah.
So nobody argues that life can come, microbes can fly through the space and asteroids and comets and see the planets. But that's not what I'm talking about. That's fine. That's one level. I'm talking about a different kind of seeding. I'm talking about seeding of multicellular organisms, not single-celled organisms like a microbe. I'm talking about seeding hydra, fish, and amphibians and reptiles and even the basis
right.
of modern, eventually man or what would develop into man. So that's where it becomes more relevant. So the seeding aspect, I mean, Crick is he was the one that had panspermia. A lot of people agree with him. I'm sure people don't. Mm-hmm. Scientists never agree on anything. There's always a war going on. It's always it's like politics, you know, left or right, you know. But the point is that it's physically, or let's just say academically and evolutionarily impossible for mankind to have evolved from 550 million BC when the ice cubes melt and when the oceans were around and we didn't have an ice cube planet going on. It doesn't make sense. The Cambrian explosion during the Cambrian era is simply not possible by typical evolutionary principles. That's what I'm saying.
Interesting. Let's get back to Egypt. And in your book, you describe both Osiris and Isis as human beings, which I personally believe they were. That were
time travelers. When they say it's not just human beings, they were time travelers from the 31st century.
Oh, okay. Well, they talk a little bit about them. They were tall, Caucasian, blue eyes, and you write that they came and they were deliverers in a way. Talk a little bit about them.
Okay, so remember, it's about 3050 BC, the 31st century AD, I should say, not BC, AD. Tatos is the scientist who is working for the government at the time, and he develops this wormhole linear accelerator. We call that the WLA, and this enlarges wormholes from a subatomic size to classic size, allows the craft to go in it, and traveling through the wormhole, they can go back in time. Now, Kip Thorne, the famous astrophysicist at Caltech in Pasadena here in Southern California, he's the one who out-debated Stephen Hawking about the existence of black holes. The guy's a brilliant guy, and he was also the consultant for the Contact movie, you know, right?
Okay.
He actually wrote a scientific article describing what I'm about to say in the Physical Review Letters in 1988, which nobody has disavowed. So he gave the mathematical model for what I'm about to describe. So the theoretical background of what this is really not questionable. If the math works, it works. It's as simple as that. So anyway, so Tatos developed this wormhole linear accelerator. So his team, his time traveler team, consisted of him, Tatos, which, by the way, the ancient Egyptians referred to as Thoth, and the Greeks called him Hermes. That's Tatos, okay? His other co-conspirators here, or shall we say his fellow team members, were Geb, Isis, Osiris. Okay, got that? So these are all Egyptian gods, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Horus, by the way. Let's not forget the little one, the young one, Horus. He was the ingenue at the time. So all those five members were the first time traveler team. And, of course, they were worshipped and immortalized in ancient Egypt as gods. But they were human. They were time travelers, or what we call chrononauts from the future.
Wow. Okay. So they disseminated information to the less evolved inhabitants.
Well, first of all, they kept the peace because, remember, there was a lot of wars going on in ancient Egypt. You had a unification mm-hmm. of – it's almost like the Vietnam War or North-South Korea. Whenever you have a country with people with similar backgrounds but different philosophies or different logistical locations, you're going to have problems. We had a civil war in this country 150 years ago, you know? Okay, so their purpose was to keep the peace and also to develop us spiritually, because these time travelers are very spiritual. By the way, these time travelers lived to be between 500 and 900 years old. You talk about the Old Testament and about some of these patriarchs like Adam and all these other kind of things, you know? Think about that, okay? They're very spiritual, very technologically advanced, and they helped us. They helped help us keep the peace and keep us from killing each other off, because Egypt was a real war zone. It was a major, major problem. It's always been a problem, but it was definitely a big problem before the flood.
Okay. Now, do you? We've had Dr. Joseph Farrell on here, who believes he has a hypothesis that the Great Pyramid of Cheops was an actual weapon. What is your feeling about that? And by the way,
I don't know about that. I do know that the purpose of the pyramid was not to put the pharaoh's body in there, because they never found the pharaoh in there. The purpose was an ascension device. Because if you look at the way it's designed, the Orion's constellation was real big, and the Sirius, you know, the dog star,
right.
You can actually see that in the Great Pyramid if you look at the mentality, the way it's constructed. But the purpose of the Pyramid of Giza, if not the other two in the Giza Plateau, was really for ascension. Remember, the first resurrected person in history is not Jesus, it's Osiris. Okay? Egypt gave us resurrection. Think about it, okay? And we don't even know the origin. We don't even know the dates involved. We know when Osiris lived in the 31st century, but we don't know how many times he lived in ancient Egypt. They went back a lot of times. So he goes back thousands of years B.C., okay? So the resurrection is a symbolic or representation or a mechanism for ascension, which means you perfect the soul, you rejoin the God energy complex, you don't come back. You see, so that's where the Pyramid of Giza was an ascension vehicle, mostly for the pharaohs, because they were elitists. You know, they didn't care about the common people. They cared about the pharaohs. That was their god. Pharaoh was their god, basically, direct representation of God.
Okay.
So that was the purpose. Now, having it as a weapon, I have no evidence of that. I've heard the theories before, but I have no evidence from my regression. I've done a lot of regressions from ancient Egypt. I've never documented that aspect.
What I don't understand, though, is that it wasn't built by the Atlanteans or the Lemurians. It wasn't built by ETs. You said it was built by time travelers. Why would time travelers?
No. It wasn't built by time travelers. It was supervised by them. The time travelers had something called an anti-gravity flying craft. And I picture that in the Egypt book. It's a triangular-shaped craft. It's about 9 feet long.
This is the craft that was used by
the ETs were involved, and they trained some of the locals to use to do that too. So they would move the boulders. Remember, these were tons, hundreds of tons. These boulders were ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they had to put them within a quarter of an inch of accuracy. Good luck trying to do that yourself. So they were helping them by moving the boulders, but the actual mechanical work, the masonry work, was done by the locals. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the ETs were around too, but they weren't doing the grunt work. These were the supervisors. They were just moving the boulders, and then the locals would direct them where to put them in place. But they had, you know. And by the way, let me tell you something, that this is where history becomes a real problem to me. This is a joke. They talk about, 100,000 slaves in 20 years who built the pyramids. Let me tell you what that's a scam. Let me give you the joke. First of all, there are many Silk and West, the late West. They were at the Giza Plateau. Do you know how many huts they found? There was about 3,000 huts. If you're going to have 100,000 people with the slaves, with the wives, with the kids, and you're going to have like a 500,000 huts around, okay? Not 3,000, okay?
Right.
You don't need that many huts because you got anti-gravity flying crafts doing most of the grunt work. So you don't need that many. And they weren't slaves, by the way. They were farmers. There were no slaves building Egypt. With all due respect to the movie The Ten Commandments, you know, it was built by farmers. They took the time off because the Nile would overflow and they couldn't work 3 or 4 months a year. And that's when they would go there and build the pyramids. But because of the ETs and the time travel, the supervision and their technology, it was built in a lot shorter period of time.
Wow.
With a lot less men, too.
It's an ascension tool of some kind. So when you say
ascension device,
what does that mean when someone is ascending? What does that mean?
All right, that means that at the end of your life, here's the problem. You have a soul or subconscious mind, okay? The Egyptians would probably call that the Ka, okay? And then you have what we call the higher self or the superconscious mind, named by Plato, by the way. And the higher self is the perfect part of your soul, which comes from the God energy complex. So what ascension is, you want to merge the subconscious with the higher self, the superconscious, become one with it, remove all the karmic debts, Now you leave your physical body, which now fertilizes the lawn in the nitrogen cycle, and then the soul's energy moves up out of the earth plane into the higher planes, into what we call the God energy complex, to combine and rejoin the God energy complex, living in what you would call heaven or nirvana. That's what it means. In other words, you don't reincarnate. You only reincarnate when you have karmic debts, when you have lessons that you haven't learned, and you still have to be here.
Interesting. Hey, talk about the Egyptian kings. Now, were they hybrids of like some of the people like Sitchin talks about, the Sumerian kings and the Anunnaki?
Well, initial Egyptian kings were, of course, were time travelers. They were the first pharaohs. You see, they were some of the early pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now the other, they were supervising it, and then of course you had locals who wanted to become pharaohs. So they were selected. They were trying to take what they thought were the most intelligent ones, the ones that were easily trainable and not just greedy, looking for power hungry maniacs. Okay, you know, it's not always easy to do. But the early pharaohs, Tatos was pharaoh several times, as was Osiris and Horus also a few times. So they were establishing it. We're talking about a long time before the first dynasty. The first dynasty with Nor-Ahar, or the Scorpion King, that was about 3100 BC for what we call the first dynasty. Okay.
Okay.
So. But the first pharaohs per se. See, if you read, like, let me give you a good example of this. The chronology is very important here, because the orientation of ancient Egypt doesn't fit into the normal cycle of evolution. Okay, I just told you because of the technology. So they had to have some help involved, and that's where the time travel is. Come in here. So basically, they were, even though they selected people to be pharaohs, and then of course their families would take over and this and that, they made a lot of mistakes. Okay, you can see the wars that came on. If you study Egyptian history from the first dynasty on, you'll see there were a lot of problems, a lot of maniac leaders and this and that. So they had their little issues. But again, the time travelers was, if it wasn't for the time travelers, there would be no real significant development in Egypt. They were critical to Egypt's development. Number one, keeping them alive without killing each other. Okay. And then secondly, throwing in the technology. Now, a couple of things that have been around, that the Temple of Dendera in Cairo today, this is important because there is a wall carving which shows the development or the existence of electricity in ancient Egypt. In fact, if you look at it, if you're listening, they just Google Dendera in Egypt, you'll get it online. You'll see it's actually this depiction is actually showing a primitive TV set. It's a Crookes tube with electricity on the conservative level, with braided cables, and these two slaves who are working this, and they look like they have a producer's or headset on them. I mean, this is like really heavy stuff, okay? And this is a wall carving that was dated to the Ptolemy era, which is 2300 to 2000 years ago. Okay, there's no argument about the dates of that. And then you look at another one. There's a Abydos, the Temple of Abydos, which is about 300 miles south of Cairo. They show you this beautiful picture, and just all they have to do is Google Abydos. You'll get it. You're going to see a wall carving, again, dated to the Ptolemy era, which will show a helicopter, UFOs, and a stealth jet.
And this is 2000. Yeah, I see that. It's okay? On the temple ceiling, right.
Right. So what did we learn from that? And by the way, that was actually hidden. It was actually covered by another thing when somebody was discovering it. The old thing, carving fell off, and this was released underneath. So it was hidden for many, many years, for hundreds of years. So basically, those two examples show advanced technology. Okay, I mean,
right.
Where does ancient Egypt come up with a stealth jet or a helicopter or a UFO? Okay,
yeah.
I mean, Da Vinci wasn't Egyptian, okay? So these are examples of showing you how Egypt was a lot more sophisticated than we give it credit to. But remember, Egypt is the source of everything. You have to understand,
right.
As I mentioned earlier, and there's also the theological base, too, because of Akhenaten. He came up with his monotheism and eventually... here's a good example. Now, the history of Egypt, there was a very important man named Manetho. Manetho was a Heliopolis priest about the 4th century BC. Now, Heliopolis is actually the Cairo area. It was like one of the cities where we call Cairo today. Okay, so this guy was a historian. He was an obsessive, compulsive, probably a Virgo historian who gave us all the king's list of all the pharaohs from the first dynasty all the way up until his time. He obviously wouldn't know about Cleopatra because she was later. So he gave us the king's list with the approximate dates, by the way. So people say, how do we know this guy wasn't just high on, you know, whatever? And no, he was corroborated by independent sources. So Manetho is a brilliant guy, and he was obviously accurate. Well, he talks about, when he talks about Akhenaten, now this is interesting. He talks about Akhenaten. He didn't know Akhenaten's name because Akhenaten was the first monotheist. And when he got rid of all the Egyptian cults, like the Osirian cult and everything, he just established Ra Heraki, or Ra the sun god, as the only god. And he was eventually killed in the 18th year of his reign. Well, Akhenaten had a chief advisor who was like his sergeant at arms, who was eventually was to be his successor, who was a scribe and a politician and a very brilliant guy. And his name was Osiriseph. Now, Osiriseph was named after Osiris. Well, when Akhenaten became the monotheist in the 4th year of his reign or 5th year of his reign, he said, yo, bro, we got a prob here, okay? You got to lose your name. There's no more Osiris. Do you know what Osiriseph changed his name to? Moses.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, uh-oh was right. Moses is not an Egyptian, a Hebrew name, by the way. It means water bearer or to be born, depending on who you read. It's not a Hebrew name. And there were a lot of pharaohs in Egypt that had the suffix Moses, Thutmoses, for example. Okay, there were lots of them. So Moses is an Egyptian name, which means we got a problem here because, you know, in the Old Testament, Egypt is the enemy, right? Well, the enemy is us because Moses was Egyptian and so were her followers. And they eventually, during the Exodus, it's a very complicated story, but Egyptians were the ones who settled Canaan, which became Israel today.
So this is fantastic, Bruce. We're going to have you back.
Sure.
This is just such a... an amazing unfolding. What can you tell us about your website? Where's your website, and what's going on with you in the near future in terms of events?
Okay, the website is www.dr, that's D as in David, R as in Robert, and then you spell out Bruce, BruceGoldberg.com. If they go there, you're going to see articles on there. All my books are on there. If you mention the show and you want to order the Egypt book on my site, not from Amazon or any other bookstore, but if you order my Egypt book from my site and mention the show, you'll get a free fifth-dimensional travel CD. Okay, so that's one thing there. Those of you listeners that don't like to use computers, which I'm sure is most of them, they can also call my toll-free number, which is 1-800-KARMA-4-U, which is 1-800-527-6248. There are also videos on there as well as YouTube, which shows actual sessions of me working with people, taking them into past and future lives. There's a time traveler contactee on there. There's an ET contactee on there. There's also Jerry Springer's past life that I took him to. That is on the site too. So there's a lot of fun things, and there's also about 30 different articles about they can read about the various techniques I do.
Fantastic. The book is Egypt, an Extraterrestrial and Time Travel Experiment. My guest today has been Dr. Bruce Goldberg. Bruce, as always, it's been a pleasure, and let's have you back again.
My pleasure. Thank you. Now, take care. Now.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Bruce Goldberg. That was an interesting point of view. For more information on his work, you can go to Amazon, go to Dr. Bruce Goldberg, or just punch in Past Lives, Future Lives, and you'll get a whole list of his books. That's it for today. I hope you have a great week, and we will talk to you next Saturday.